Greetings, fellow humans, and welcome to Off Grid with me, Dave.
And me, Void.
Yes, it's the Not Really About Crosswords podcast. Now, before each episode, we've sat across a table from a cryptic crossword and shone a light in its eyes until it sang like a canary. As a result, we've each extracted a word from it for something to talk about.
The puzzle we looked at this time was by Falcon in the Financial Times, number 17586, on Tuesday the 28th of November 2023. If you don't want spoilers, then go and solve it first. Link in the blog.
Otherwise, listen on. We'll also have a short quiz inspired by the puzzle, for which we will naturally require general knowledge. So, General, are you there and how are you?
I'm here, thanks. Glad to be here.
Marvellous.
We've also each picked one favourite clue from the puzzle. If cryptic clues are lost on you, don't panic. We'll explain them in due course. So, Dave, what was your favourite clue, please?
The one I chose was 10 across, which said, a vegetable that's given away in French in seven letters. And for the benefit of those listening in black and white who can't hear the spelling, the first in there is I-N and the second is I-N-N. Yeah, you can have a think about that or not. It's up to you. Either way, I'll explain how it works after we've heard something from the general. Which word in the puzzle caught your eye and why?
Yeah, right away I saw the word walrus, which stuck out to me. Walrus is always an animal that I thought's kind of a fun animal. And when I started to think about it a little bit, I started to think about a very puzzly person and a writer that I've enjoyed a lot myself. Are you folks familiar at all with The Walrus and the Carpenter?
Aha, we have Lewis Carroll.
Lewis Carroll, absolutely. Yeah. So Lewis Carroll, I don't know how much you've heard about him and puzzles in particular. One thing that I learned from an American book about crosswords is that he came up with a version of Scrabble, sort of a proto-Scrabble to play with his friends. He also was interested in double acrostics, but a little bit more searching.
What's a double acrostic?
I think the idea is that it goes down both sides, perhaps.
Yeah, I think you've got both the initial letters of the lines and the last letters of the lines.
Okay,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes. And then also, I sort of decided I'd do a little bit more looking into what kind of puzzle stuff he was into. One of the things that I found was an interesting site at the University of Hawaii. A professor emeritus of mathematics named G.N. Heil has a whole page about him.
I was going to say, I think he was a maths teacher as well, wasn't he? So
yes, he was.
He'd be into maths puzzles as well as word puzzles.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a mathematics professor at Oxford, and he would put it in his works periodically. The Mock Turtle talks about arithmetic in Alice in Wonderland and says that the four branches of arithmetic are ambition, distraction, uglification, and derision.
Nice.
Yes, yeah. This is quite a playful site. Essentially, this is the personal website of this retired professor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with, it's notes for a maths 101 class that he teaches there.
Okay.
And one of the big lessons is about systematic reasoning. And he has the logic puzzles of Lewis Carroll. And I was wondering if you might be interested in having a look at one of these puzzles.
An audio look, would that be?
An audio look, indeed. Yes, yes. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it.
Yeah.
I'll read from Heil's page here. It says, math teacher at Oxford. As a teacher of logic and lover of nonsense, Carroll designed entertaining puzzles to train people in systematic reasoning. In these puzzles, he strings together a list of implications, purposefully inane, so that the reader is not influenced by any preconceived opinions. The job of the reader is to use all of the listed implications to arrive at an inescapable conclusion. You will get the general idea after a few examples. We'll begin with one of Lewis Carroll's simpler puzzles and work our way up to harder ones. But we'll look at one of them. And the three implications that he puts forth are A, all babies are illogical. B, nobody is despised who can manage a crocodile. And C, illogical persons are despised.
So this is a syllogism, isn't it, really?
Say more about that.
Oh, sorry. It's it's the thing where you have two premises and a conclusion. So that structure, yeah, it's you're saying about avoiding things that have got stuff you just know anyway. The traditional one is all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. And you've got to give, well, it's fairly obvious that Socrates is mortal anyway. So you don't have to do the critical thinking on it, which is what he's presumably trying to make you avoid there.
So this example you've just given us, it's one where I'd like to see it written down.
I was going to say, I think you need to write it down, but yeah, we could just get in your head is a little kind of mind-mangling.
First memories of how you said it, I'm guessing the trap is that all babies are crocodiles, or crocodiles eat babies, or something.
You would think. Well, it does come to a fairly logical conclusion. I'll walk you through the way that it's solved here. How about that?
Yeah.
So basically, what this professor says to do is to make some simpler statements from the implications that Carol's given you, which is that B, it is a baby; L, it is logical; M, it can manage a crocodile; and D, it is despised. And he places them in an order. He says B, L, D, M. And basically, here's what that means. If it is a baby, then it cannot manage a crocodile, because a baby is illogical, and illogical persons are despised. Nobody is despised who can manage a crocodile, and so a baby is incapable of managing a crocodile. Or rather, anyone who can manage a crocodile is not a baby.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
One more thing I noticed when I was reading about the walrus and the carpenter. Did you know that it was the inspiration from a big psychedelic hit of the 1960s? Or partial inspiration.
The Walrus and the Carpenter, is that a poem that's within Alice's Adventures in Wonderland?
Yeah, it might have been in the second book. It might be in
Familiar Grass. Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Be a 1967 hit, then?
It would be, yeah.
By a band that's changed their name more than once.
Ooh, I think they did, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that's White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane.
Ooh, my goodness, that's fantastic. I was thinking of a different band that matches those same criteria.
Well, I'll probably come back to the White Rabbit later on.
The White Rabbit might not be derived from Walrus and the Carpenter, but it is from Alice in Wonderland.
It is from Alice in Wonderland, yeah, exactly.
Because one pill makes you smaller, another makes you tall.
Okay, yeah. Here's what
the
I'm
ones
thinking.
The mother gives you don't do anything at all.
What's the one that you're thinking
of? I love the bass line to that song. It's a very nice
bass. So the Walrus and the Carpenter is... Yeah, walrus. The walrus.
I am the walrus.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the leave is 67. I might be wrong about the year. I might.
Yeah,
might
have Sergeant Pepper as well.
Yeah.
Cuckoo, cuckoo.
And so, what really I thought was very funny is that it was part of the inspiration for the song, and you know, John Lennon had his acid trip, and he wrote the whole song, and he got it done, and then he was dismayed to find out that, spoilers, the walrus is the villain. Yeah. Not so happy. He should have read it first, perhaps. Could have had a different song.
In that sort of circumstances, that you always say, well, yes, that's exactly what I meant. You know, it's an allegory.
Of course.
I am the walrus. I hate myself.
you could draw up a few statements about that and then have people put them in order.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm not going to go and analyze the lyrics of I'm the walrus, because... yeah, as you say, there's probably Trip-inspired.
Hiding to Nothing, possibly, as well.
I wonder if it's been reviewed on TripAdvisor. Oh, dear.
Pretty good.
Now, Lennon was quite literary himself, though. He wrote a couple of collections of poems, didn't he? And he liked to hang out with various authors. Didn't he hang out with Hunter S. Thompson for a bit?
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
Interesting. I suppose anybody would hang out with you if you were John Lennon.
That's true, yeah.
No, sorry, John, I'm busy.
I don't actually know the Walrus and the Carpenter very well. Cabbages and Kings, is that in it?
Oh, yeah, Cabbages and Kings. Yeah, that's in it. It's quite a long poem. It's four big pages.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, essentially what happens is that this very crafty walrus, he's sort of a sweet talker, and they propose a walk along the beach and say, "Oysters, would you come out of your bed?" And the old oysters say, "I know you, you know, I won't be joining you on the beach." And all the babies are like, "That sounds fantastic, and let's jump up." And everyone goes for a walk, and then the walrus and the carpenter stop and eat them all. Absolute villain.
Right, okay. Yeah. So, there we go. Now, Dave, do you want to tell us how your clue worked, please? Your favourite clue?
Yeah, if you remember, vegetable that's given away in French Inn. This was a deletion clue, so perhaps it'll sound clearer if I reread it as vegetable that's given away in French Inn. Basically, you're looking for a seven-letter French inn that results from taking the letters I-N out of a presumably nine-letter vegetable, and that's auberge from aubergine. Quite a nice surface misdirection about free food. General, what about your choice of clue?
The clue that I liked was 27 across, and it was heavenly body of a bodybuilder. Eight letters.
Right, so we'll come back to the answer for that after Void's choice of word. What leapt off the page for you?
Well, I almost got deja vu choosing this word because, Dave, you've previously chosen asterisk as your favourite word, but I picked asteroid.
Aha.
Now, I'd like to ask you, do you think it ever rains on asteroids?
I would say, do you mean raining a particular substance? I would imagine it probably doesn't rain water on asteroids, but maybe some other things. You know, you get like methane rains on some of the planets and things like that. Perhaps.
Okay, well, I've checked the log, and it turns out that Lyle Rains and Ed Lug have designed the classic arcade game Asteroids.
Deary me.
Which I spent a few 10p's on way back when. And while I was looking things up, I found a quick nostalgia trip, because you can now play it online for free.
Of course.
It's difficult to put a 10p coin into your computer these days. Link in the blog, folks. But
I'm just looking at the SD card slot in the front of my laptop. Right. Just about the right size for a 10p. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually picked asteroids because I thought it might be fun to look up who or what some asteroids have been named after.
Oh, lots of, yeah.
Yeah, but first I'm going to ask you, can you name any asteroids?
Arthur Dent.
Oh, is there an Arthur Dent asteroid?
I'm pretty sure there is, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Is this like people John Lennon hung out with? Do you just throw names out?
I mean, it's quite possible. I mean, I was thinking that there are a few asteroids people might have heard of.
Well, there's the kind of ones, the series, things like that, that are kind of at the larger end and might be called minor planets.
Yeah, Ceres is the first one that was discovered, and I think it is the biggest. There's Vesta, Juno, Pallas, and Europa. So those are common names you might have heard of. Now, you did just mention minor planets, and there isn't actually an IAU definition of an asteroid. So we have a sort of it isn't other things definition. So an irregularly shaped rocky body orbiting the sun that does not qualify as a planet or dwarf planet under the IAU definitions of those terms. So yeah, from here on in, I'll be referring to data on what are referred to as minor planets as being synonymous with asteroids. And the first one that caught my eye, name-wise, was I read that 482 Petrina was the first minor planet to be named after a dog. And I wondered, I wonder if that's Petra.
As in Blue Peter?
Yeah, it's a 1960s dog in a UK kids TV show, General. But the discovery date of Petrina was 1902, so I thought probably not. And it took a bit of looking around and finding and digging to find out, but I found out that it was named after the pet dog of the discoverer, whose name was M. Wolf.
Is that the same guy who there's a star called Wolf 359, isn't there? So was that named after him? Was he the same guy?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't look further about him.
Okay,
I just thought, you know, with a name like Wolf, he's obviously canine inclined.
Okay. Yeah.
So having found the first asteroid named after a dog, I then looked for...
Others? Is there a Snoopy?
No, I then looked for the first one named after a cat.
Oh, of course. Yes, pets.
And there is one, and it was 2309 Mr. Spock, discovered by Jay Gibson in 1971.
And wow. Jay Gibson confirmed it was definitely his cat and not a character out of an old TV series.
Well, I'm presuming he is the source of the quote that I found, which says, named for the ginger short-haired tabby cat, born 1967, who selected the discoverer and his soon-to-be wife at a cat show in California and accompanied them to Connecticut, South Africa, and Argentina. At El Leoncito, he provided endless hours of amusement, brought home his trophies, dead or alive, and was a figure of interest to everyone who knew him. He was named after the character in the television program Star Trek, who was also imperturbable, logical, intelligent, and had pointy ears.
Pointy ears will come back to later as well.
Oh, okay. Ooh. Yeah. So Vale, Mr. Spock. And from this household's point of view, I was also pleased to find that 105 Artemis and 1862 Apollo both exist too. The latter actually gives its name to a whole class of Earth-crossing asteroids, ones that cross the Earth's orbit.
Orbit.
As viewed from above the orbital plane, so not necessarily exactly crossing. So we don't need to be too worried about
it. Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah. Okay, a couple more asteroids. 45 Eugenia was the first to be named after a living person in 1857. Any ideas who that might be?
Eugenia? You say 57?
1857.
1850,
almost. Maybe I should pronounce it Eugenia.
Eugene.
She was French. She was the wife and empress of Napoleon III.
Okay.
Yes, we mentioned possible asteroid danger. 1997 XR2 was the first asteroid to be rated above zero on the Torino scale, which runs from 0 to 10, and this rating was 1. Which represents threats to Earth. But you'll be glad to hear it was later downgraded to zero.
Right.
And I think that 99942 Apophis is the one that's had the highest rating on the Torino scale, which was 4.
Right.
Which has also been downgraded to zero now.
Do we have like the definitions of these different ratings? I.e., if something were rated 10, would that mean I can see it in the sky heading for me?
Well, I did have a quick look. Some, they were colour-coded. So zero was obviously green. 1 to 4 were coloured amber. And I think 5 was the first that was coloured red. And even 5 was something like 1% chance of having a major impact in a region.
Right.
So still, we're all probably fine, but perhaps we should keep our eyes on it. I didn't actually look at what 10 was, but yeah, it's probably something like you described.
10 is, we're the new dinosaurs!
Yeah. Yeah, so there are asteroids named after lots of different humans, scientists, royalty, explorers, Alexander von Humboldt, who we've mentioned.
Yay.
Historians, philosophers, writers... Douglas Adams. I didn't see an Arthur Dent, but there probably is one if I look
I think fictional characters do get in there as well.
Yeah. There's all three Bronte sisters who we've mentioned. There's Molière who we've mentioned.
Mm.
There are composers, sports people, but only one cricketer, Don Bradman. There are musicians. We've mentioned Enya in passing. And we might have mentioned Yoko Ono. Well, we've mentioned John Lennon today. So
sure. Yeah.
Actors, Peter Falk, a.k.a. Columbo, but not his wife. And lastly, under entertainment / other...
Are you going to tell me there are podcasters who had asteroids named after them?
Well, the one I was looking at is 3163 Randy, which is named for James Randy, magician, skeptic, and pseudoscience investigator / debunker, who passed away in 2020. But in 2008, he had a podcast.
Oh, well, so, there we are.
Yes, there's hope for us yet. So that's all I've got on asteroids.
Right. Well, in the meantime, then, General, come back and tell us how that clue worked.
Yeah, well, you might have figured out at this point that the answer to heavenly body of a bodybuilder is asteroid.
Oh, that's an extraordinary coincidence.
An extraordinary coincidence. Yeah, indeed, a heavenly body is an asteroid, and a bodybuilder is a steroid.
Yeah, it's sneaky misdirection of a bodybuilder not being a person, but a substance that might build your body up. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Okay, Void, you've got a clue choice as well to give us. What's that one?
Yeah, I went for 14 across as my favourite, which is cash lost in 'em in resort, ? And that's 4.8 apostrophe EM, so abbreviation of them. Cash lost in 'em in resort. And I'll come back and explain that one after Dave tells us a story. What you got, Dave?
Similarly to the aforementioned walrus, I was looking at the word rabbit at 2 down. Rabbit obviously also occurs in the form of white rabbit in Lewis Carroll's work. So I was wondering, when I solved those two quite early on, if we were going to get a sort of Lewis Carroll theme. But it turned out no. Anyway, did you know that the word rabbit, we originally used it only to refer to the young of the species, and therefore we had a different word for the adults?
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I do know another word.
There's one I'm thinking of, too.
What are you thinking of, General?
Well, I was wondering if it might be Coney.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's the one, which really kind of only survives now in a Brooklyn amusement park peninsula, really.
Sam Gamgee talks about catching conies in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, it's more of Tolkien's kind of interest in sort of old language and etymology. Yeah, and do you know why the word fell out of use?
Ooh, no.
In favour of rabbit?
Is it something about coney that people decided they didn't like, or is it something about rabbit that people decided they did like?
The former.
Oh, okay. Oh, is it a Norman invasion thing?
No, it's more of a Victorian squeamishness, because in common use it wasn't pronounced coney.
Okay.
If you think about how you pronounce M-O-N-E-Y and H-O-N-E-Y, I think you'll see the problem, and people got a bit about that and decided, let's use a different word instead.
Okay.
Wow. Anyway.
I'm sure all the people in Scunthorpe were fine with it. But
yeah, that sort of thing. There we go, yeah. Still, that got me thinking about white rabbits, which, first of all, led me to wonder about the superstition of saying white rabbits at the start of the month for good luck. Is that a thing you guys are familiar with?
Vaguely.
Vaguely.
Yeah, I've sort of heard some people say it, but I think I don't think it's something I heard when I was young.
So well,
it's moderately new to me.
It was certainly newish to me as well. It's another one of those things like, you know, pinch punch first of the month and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
I thought I'd try and track down the origin of this. I started looking online, and there was lots of websites that all kind of cross-cited each other, and they were all obviously referring to just one original reference. I'll quote this, what they all referred to said, white rabbits was written in the Notes and Queries book from 1909, and it reads, my two daughters are in the habit of saying rabbits on the first day of each month. The word must be spoken aloud and must be the first word said in the month. It brings luck for that month. Other children, I find, use the same formula. Unquote. Now, firstly, you're going to, what do they mean, the Notes and Queries book from 1909? What? Notes and Queries was, and indeed still is, a periodical journal of English language, literature, lexicography, history, scholarly antiquarianism, and so on. It started in 1849. It's currently published by the Oxford University Press.
Okay.
So I thought, oh, well, you know, it goes straight to the horse's mouth. The OUP will have a digitised archive on it, of it online. And which they do. It was a bit fiddly to search and find the thing, but I did find that quotation. It was in the March the 13th, 1909 edition, written by a correspondent signing himself only A.M. And after the bit that's been quoted, there's a follow-up sentence where he says, I shall be glad to know if this is a common and old custom, and what is the meaning of rabbits?
So he didn't think to ask his daughters where they had got it from or if they'd invented it.
Well, you know, 2 weeks later in the March the 27th edition, a James Platt replies with, my little daughter has for some time been in the habit of saying rabbit on the first day of each month. The word, to be most efficacious, must be spoken up the chimney and be the first word said in the month. I am told that if this is done, the performer will receive a present. Now, he doesn't elaborate as to whether the person by whom he is told this is his little daughter. At any rate, those two letters seem to have been the whole of the correspondence. So AM, as far as I can see, never got an explanation of the origin. And so therefore, neither do we, rather disappointingly. So that's the end of that line of thought.
I want to know who AM is now.
Who AM is? Well,
1909.
Yeah, it's not.
AA Milne?
we should be so lucky that it's any kind of celebrity.
Yeah.
A thought of white rabbits and sort of superstition reminds me that there is an old, turns out to be a baseless Hollywood superstition, that movies whose titles contain a question mark will bomb at the box office. And so lots of films whose titles have got what is patently a question as their title, you will find without a question mark on the end. And I think the obvious example there is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, which, okay.
If you go and look at it, it has not got a question mark on it.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. So it's a statement.
Well, it's, you,
that it follows on from a name that we haven't been told.
Yeah, this is so-and-so who framed Roger Rabbit. Yeah. If you've seen the film, you know the answer, but anyhow.
I've seen the film, but I can't remember so long ago.
Yeah, I mean, I was a child when I saw that film. It scared me very badly.
Remember me, Valiant, when I killed your brother? You remember that, yeah? Anyway, finally, thought of cartoon rabbits brings me to the most famous one of them all, Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
But is he a rabbit?
Ah, now.
Or is he a hare?
Yeah, now, wasn't the first cartoon he appeared in, wasn't it called Harebrained or something like that?
Well, got this marvellous book here, which is called Bugs Bunny, 50 Years and Only One Grey Hair, which is basically the biography of the character, really. On the one hand, the titles of some of his most famous cartoons, Rabbit of Seville, Rhapsody Rabbit, Rabbit Seasoning, Dark Rabbit, Dark, and so on, would seem to be clear on the matter. But, as you just said, there's hair-raising hair, old grey hair, devil may hair, compressed hair, Roman legion hair, and so on. And yeah, his first appearance in a sort of primitive proto-form was in a 1938 Porky Pig cartoon called Porky's Hair Hunt.
Right.
And the first appearance in the recognisable form as that's Bugs Bunny, I know who that is, was in a 1940 Elmer Fudd cartoon called A Wild Hare.
Right.
Yeah, you might say, well, those hair titles are mostly there just for puns, right? I went and I looked at pictures of real rabbits and hares. So yeah. You kind of go, well, you know, how do they differ? And, you know, the hare is bigger than the rabbit, but the most prominent thing you notice straight away as a difference between the two of them is the ears. Yeah. On a hare, the ears are long and quite pointy.
Mm.
And if you kind of ignore lop-eared varieties and only look at those whose ears stand erect, in rabbits, they're shorter and rounder. And what sort of ears does Bugs have? Tall, pointy ones.
And to the question of, is he a rabbit or a hare? I mean, his name isn't Bugs Hare or Bugs Rabbit. It's not Bugs exactly. Bunny. So the question is, what does bunny mean?
Well, yeah. I think, funnily enough, I was looking at the word bunny. I think I did look up, and that originally was a diminutive name for a squirrel. So don't go down that route. But there is a species, Lepus californicus,
okay,
which goes by more than one name. It's known as the black-tailed jackrabbit, or the American desert hare. So you can go, this thing's bloody got both hare and rabbit, isn't it? But it has tall, pointy ears. It is grey, and it is a species indigenous to that sort of western United States area where the Warner Brothers animators were living and working. So I think that's problem. Okay, he hasn't got a black tail, he's got a white tail, but that aside, you know.
I but think essentially, they looked out the window and thought, right, and how do we gather draw guy.
The one.
Yeah, that's the one. So, Boyd, I think your clue takes us from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, perhaps. Give us the answer and the parsing, if you will.
Indeed, yes. This is a type of clue we call an andlet, or a clueless definition, in which the whole of the clue is the definition, and also the whole of the clue is the wordplay. So the key here is the word resort at the end, which isn't actually resort, it's resort. So in other words, it's an anagram indicator, and if you anagramize cash lost in them, you get slot machines, and you might lose your cash in them in a resort such as Vegas. So I thought that was a very nice little clue.
It was a great one, yeah.
Mm, beautiful. All right, are you two ready for a quiz?
Ooh,
hit us with it.
Yes.
It's a walrus quiz.
Okay.
I read a lot about walruses this week. I've been thinking about them. I've been thinking about their whiskers, which are called vibrissae.
Yeah.
How many? This is a sort of multi-part question. Okay. How many vibrissae do you figure a walrus has? Roughly.
Ooh.
In what zone are we with the vibrissae?
I'll say a dozen pairs. A dozen on each side of it. A dozen on each cheek.
Yeah, because you think of kind of large bristly ones, but you think I bet they've got smaller, finer ones as well. It's probably, I'll say quadruple what Void said.
Yeah, it's just something like that. It's in the hundreds. That's what I can tell you about hundreds of vibrissae. They are sensitive, like the whiskers of a cat.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think they're for? Vibrissae. This is still part of question one.
Right.
Well, I would imagine there'd be all sorts of uses. I mean, certainly for a cat, it's going to be feeling its way in the dark and things. So it's when you're in a narrow space or something, things like that, isn't there?
I mean, I would imagine.
But I would imagine a walrus probably doesn't have that scenario.
Yeah, it's more likely to be used in the water for a walrus. Mm. So because it's got various different lengths and pointing at angles, mm-hmm, and lots of them,
I guess they're for detecting currents.
Ooh. Well, they are for you're right on the right track. Take it all the way down to the ocean floor, and the walrus will swim along the ocean floor.
I was going to say maybe kind of snuffling on the ground to feel for food or something.
Exactly. Exactly. There you have it. Mm. Yes. A signal is sent to the walrus's brain when the vibrissae have brushed against a suitable food, which, of course, is...
flatfish.
Ooh, yeah, well, sure.
Shellfish?
Yes, and? Well, one of
carpenters?
Those shellfish. Well, you might share some with the carpenter.
Chips.
They're lovely with chips.
I think this is a reference back to the earlier mention.
Yeah, you got to go back to the poem. Yeah. Oysters, right?
Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
Yes. All sorts of crustaceans, clams, mollusks, oysters, of course. Yes. Now, you too might have something, your own version of vibrissae. And this is question two, a little mini quiz round for question two. I started to think about the walrus mustache.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Many, many famous walrus mustache owners. And I thought maybe I'd nudge you a little bit towards a few of them, and we'll see if we can name some of the famous people who had walrus mustaches.
Okay.
Okay. The first chancellor of the German Empire, perhaps the most famous walrus mustache, lived in the 1800s.
That would be the Iron Duke, would it?
The
Bismarck?
It is! Otto von Bismarck. Very good, very good. Okay. We'll go across the pond now for an American president. The 26th president of the United States. Of course it is.
Oh,
can I tell you a little more?
26. Hang on. Are we talking early 1900s?
Indeed. Yeah, 1901. This man became president.
Is he some might say similarly proportioned to a walrus?
He was quite walrus-like in his stature.
Okay, Taft.
Oh, close.
Oh, it's not Taft. Okay.
Did Taft have one too?
I don't
Taft
know.
Might have had one. Oh no, I'm thinking of the one who said, "Speak softly and carry a big stick; you will go far." He was a conservationist. He was Teddy Roosevelt. Yes, helped set up our national parks.
I was going to say, I think Grover Cleveland had quite a tash, didn't he?
Yeah, there are some very nice ones.
Yeah,
some very nice ones. speaking of nice ones, I have a singer and a guitarist. Back to the 1960s, from a band called The Birds.
Yeah, passed away this year, I think.
What is time? It was recently. It might have been this year. He was in a band with an initialism as their name. He was the C of CSNY.
Yeah, he was name checked in a Robin Hitchcock song. You and David Crosby and a bloke with no hands.
Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. I have many more on this list, but I think we're going to cut to one more who surely you will know, but was shocking to me. A great British actor and comedian and QI host who I've never seen with a mustache. But apparently he had quite a walrus mustache that I've looked him up.
Well, when he was playing General Melchett, I would imagine he would have.
Oh, yes. Of
was it for a role?
Yeah.
Blackadder Goes Forth. He had a fairly huge moustache. Yes.
Yeah. Very good. Fry, yeah. Stephen Fry, yes.
I didn't know that was, you know, that was his own.
A grown one rather than stuck on or something, yeah.
Well, very dedicated actor, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We're gonna do the hard one now.
Okay.
I have been to NACBMA. I went to their website, and for those who are wondering what NACBMA is, it is the North American Charitable Beard and Mustache Alliance, and they are affiliated with the Great American Beard and Mustache Championship, which is being held in Detroit this year.
Okay.
Right.
And they actually, they have categories for the mustache. They have six categories for the mustache that is not attached to a beard.
Are these the guys who kind of originated Movember and things like that, perhaps?
It sounds like those sorts of people.
Yeah.
I cannot confirm that they are the actual people, but it's the vibe. The logo of the beard and mustache competition is a giant fist in the middle of the turret with a mustache swinging towards you. So, this should tell you everything about what's going on here.
Okay.
Anyway, so here's what I'm thinking. As it turns out, none of the six categories for mustaches are the walrus mustache, although the walrus is included in one of the categories. I thought maybe if I told you what the category was called, you could sort of figure out what they must mean by such a name for the category.
Okay.
So, the walrus, we'll give you one for free, the natural mustache, which contains the walrus mustache.
So it's just a untrimmed, free-growing top lip tash.
Just indeed, this, I would have thought.
Yeah. It's what you're showing me. Very good.
Yeah. Audio podcast, Dave. Audio podcast.
Yeah.
Yes. The mustache, as it naturally grows, the more natural, the better. No closed curls. It says no styling aids allowed. So that's the natural. The next mustache is called the Dali mustache.
Okay. So that's going to be waxed.
Pointed at the ends.
Into thin pointed curls. Yeah. Upward curls.
And there you have it. It's got to go up. And the styled Dali mustache may not extend over the eyebrows.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the kind, right, kind of rule that, you know, very few people need to have explained to them. You know.
That's a rule that has definitely been written because of one
Because somebody did, yeah.
Ralph, every year.
Yeah. I'm going to shout out to my friend Guy at this point, who is a member of the Handlebar Club, because he has a very full tash and or beard. I believe it varies, and he's entered some competitions. I'm not sure how serious they are, how much of a degree of fun it all is. I hope it's all done in fun.
I sure hope so. What's the point of a mustache if you're not having fun, right?
I guess.
Let's have a look at another. We have the English mustache.
Now I'm getting World War II flying ace.
I'm thinking David Niven. It's a sort of thin, almost pencil type moustache, I'm thinking.
Absolutely perfect. I think David Niven is a platonic ideal of an English moustache haver. The tips can be raised slightly, but the hairs must be combed from the middle of the upper lip to the sides. And in fact, quite a Niven-ish image on the website itself.
Yeah.
Okay, next we have the Hungarian / Wild West mustache.
So does that go out to the sides and then start going downwards?
Ooh, it does come out to the side, and it does go downwards, and then it comes
back out again.
Back up in a little kind of curly point at the end.
Indeed, yeah, very much. If you can think of that nameless villain from the Indiana Jones movies with the bald head and the giant mustache that Indy has the fist fight with, you know, it sort of looks
If you
can picture an old strongman or something like that.
Yes.
Yes, quite similar to that would be the Imperial mustache. The Imperial mustache. I don't know why it's called this.
So this is presumably something that an emperor would have.
Some emperors at some point, yeah.
Yeah, some emperor.
So is it a Ming the Merciless one, where it's quite thin, but it goes out wide and then down into long, thin tails?
No, that's a Fu Manchu.
Fu Manchu.
Fu Manchu, yeah.
But maybe Fu Manchu is a subcategory of...
It could be. I believe you could call it the inverted Dali, perhaps. well, the Imperial is quite small. You can imagine a bowler cap on top of it. It still does that curl up and in, but it's only the hairs on the upper lip can be grown out, and it's very tight towards the nose area.
That's feeling like David Suchet's version of Hercule Poirot.
Ah, it does sound it is a little bit like Poirot. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think he'd compete in this category. And then the last one is, this one is quite simple. It's the freestyle mustache. And the picture they show is a person who appears to have two mustaches. They've got it groomed into one and then groomed into another on the top.
Oh, yeah, I've seen a picture.
So that's do what you like, right?
Yes.
freestyle.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, if you want to put your Dolly mustache over your eyebrows, there you have it. This category is for you. No. Yeah, and that's it. That is your walrus and walrus mustache quiz.
Brilliant.
Well done.
Thank you very much.
Cool. Okay, that's about it for this episode. Thanks for listening once again. Please subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. Show notes, as always, will be at offgrid.tlmb.net. You can say hi to us on the interwebs. I'm at Skirwinkle on various social sites. Hey, why not check out my long-running, if infrequent, cartoon strip at peoplewithissues.org?
Absolutely. I am at The Void TLMB in several places, mostly Mastodon. At this point, I'd like to say hi to our new listeners in Serbia, Malta, Nepal, and Ukraine, who all appeared right after we federated the blog. So, hooray, assuming you're not bots, but, you know, hello. But that's also a chance for me to tell you that the blog is now federated, which means you can follow us on the Fediverse or Mastodon if you search for at offgridpod at offgrid.tlmb.net.
It'll be in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. General, do you have any recommendations for us this time around?
Yeah, I would recommend to you the Setter Mog in The Independent, the Blue Sky account Moss Def, and the crossword Patreon Square Chase.
I've seen some of those puzzles. They're quite neat.
Cool. Thanks for those recommendations.
Thank you.
That's all for this time, folks. We'll see you another time. Cheerio.
Bye.
Bye.
Unlike track 7 on Outside Time, the new mini album by The Trudy, this podcast does not produce itself, you know. It is a TLMB production. Thank you to Falcon and the Financial Times for the crossword. Our theme tune is by aforesaid The Trudy, who you must check out on Bandcamp or thetrudy.co.uk. This podcast is free and doesn't have any ads in it. Apart maybe from that previous sentence. But if you like both of those facts, please feel free to leave us a review. It'll only take you a minute and it'll really help us out. Thank you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing, if you do. Bye.
We're going to just to try to understand the state of the mustache.